I'm Bill Castle, and this is Free Expression. This program is all about conveying the Christian message from a Catholic point of view and defending the liberty which makes it possible to do that. We talk with creative, interesting people analyzing what makes for appropriate and effective liturgical music and providing tools and training for those engaged in spiritual warfare. Join us. Sit back and enjoy some free expression. Exorcism and spiritual warfare, deliverance ministry, these seem like the stuff of old-time tent show preachers. But the evil and the just plain weirdness we see all around us today gives these mystical concepts a whole new relevance. What can explain the widespread collapse of families or the increasing number of attacks on churches or the zeal with which so-called pro-choicers defend abortion or, Lord knows, promoting gender transition in public schools? Evil is at the heart of it all, and that automatically puts us into the spiritual realm, whether or not we wish to be there. Dr. Dan Schneider teaches theology at Franciscan University of Steubenville. This former Army helicopter pilot is a spiritual war veteran who's been involved in evangelism and deliverance ministry for nearly 20 years. He's a founding member of Liber Christo, a movement that provides tools and resources for priests and laity working in the apostolate of exorcism. And he's the author of a new work from Tan Books called The Liber Christo Method, a field manual for spiritual combat. Dan, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you for having me on the show.
It can be hard to think seriously about a spiritual war. Put it into focus for us, if you would. What's going on? How is the wickedness and disorder which we observe in the tangible world related to whatever might be happening in a higher realm?
The Catechism says that all of man's history is one of dour combat with the forces of evil from the beginning of time. So this is, as we say, the same old shoot 'em up. This has been going on from the beginning of the creation of the angels and the fall of the angels and the beginning of the creation of man and the rebellion of man to the instigation of the serpent. So from the beginning, we've been engaged in close mortal combat, single combat, if you will. I use the story of David and Goliath in the book as kind of the overall narrative story, I should say, or the narrative cohesiveness, explaining how David is called out and calls Goliath out, or Goliath calls the Israelites out, and they go into hand-to-hand combat. And there's a lot of rich symbolism that gets picked up later by the church. But from the beginning, we've battled against evil. Now, what's interesting, you mentioned seemingly preconciliar medieval notions, etc. Recently, I've done some editing for another Tan book is coming out, the biography of Father Gabriel Amorth. And Father Amorth was sort of the grandfather of exorcism at a time when, in the 70s and the 80s, it was very passé, so to speak, to believe in the devil, to believe in spiritual warfare. These were all preconciliar notions. These were all medieval notions. And now what we find ourselves in, it's no longer able to hide this. When you have sadomasochistic drag queens getting a form at the Los Angeles Dodgers, dressed as cloistered nuns, when you have Target and Bud Light and all this transgender ideology, all this stuff flies in the face of not only what's good and right, but also in the face of what's reasonable and rational. So we're living in a time of just great, as Father Ripperger calls it, diabolical disorientation. It's precisely where we're at. Another phrase that we use is the evil militates to absurdity. And we're starting to see absurdity in the public realm. And even secular commentators are starting to recognize there's real evil out there. And the church has the answers. We've been battling this from the beginning. We fight an ancient enemy, and the ancient weapons are best. And this is what I tried to do in this little book, is to try to lay out what his tactics are, and what tactics we have as our resources as Roman Catholics.
Yeah, what exactly is the Liber Christo movement, and what are you folks involved in?
It's a group of laity and deacons that work in union with putting out the protocol, Father Chet Ripperger, and his protocol, what we call the four-phase protocol, which is a way of organizing, providing some objective criteria to cases of alleged diabolic activity at the parish level, the diocesan level. So this is a program that helps support parish priests, helps support dioceses. We've got this working in several dioceses in the U.S., in Germany. I'm going to Germany soon to go work and train some teams and priests over there. So this is a way of managing cases to discern the psychological from the spiritual. That's what Liber Christo does. And the manual, I wrote it with a broader audience, not just, so we're using it with our teams in various dioceses, but it's also written for the average Catholic to pick up, and this kind of a multi-purpose tool. You know, I was a soldier and a pilot, and you had several twos in your pack that could have multiple functions, and this one is one of those. So it also serves as a catechetical guide for any Catholic who says, hey, I need to recognize areas in my life that I might have given permission over to the enemy through my own stupidity, and how do we deal with those things?
Yeah, how do you, for instance, discern a situation? Someone may indeed be acting under spiritual influence, but on the other hand, they just might be nuts. How do you tell the difference?
You think of Liber Christo and what Father Ripperger is doing as a model. And what this model is trying to do is to bring back the deliverance and exorcism ministry to Catholic norms. This is basically what we're doing. Recently in Italy, there was a case, a woman manifested the diabolic at church on a Sunday during Mass or after Mass. They usher her out to a small little remote chapel, and they pray over her for 9 hours straight. That's kind of the old gunslinging model that may have worked 20, 30 years ago, but it's not working today. Evil has grown so very strong, and the battlefield shifts. Just like when I was in Iraq, you know, when we went to Desert Storm, it was tank on tank. We absolutely destroyed them with superior training, superior technology, superior numbers, superior tactics. It was a 48-hour war that I flew in. And then within 10 years, the enemy realized they're not going to beat us in this battle. So they went primitive. They took the uniforms off. They started using IEDs. They started using civilian, that's human shields. They drew our soldiers into street combat, light intensity combat, hand-to-hand, door-to-door. And so we had to adjust our own tactics as well because the enemy changed and went primitive. And so the U.S. Army and the U.S. military, the Marines, all went primitive and had to go back and fight this enemy in a very ancient way. I see the spiritual landscape as being, that's a bit of an analogy for what's happening in the spiritual landscape. What worked 50 years ago, 20 years ago, is not working right now. And so what Father Ripperger and I and others that work in union with us are trying to restore good Catholic theology, restore orthodoxy and orthopraxy, right belief and right practice or right worship. How do we do this and do this safely? That's what we're trying to do.
Over the last couple of decades, we've gotten so deeply into the self-improvement mode. People have adopted a lot of methods to try and find inner peace or whatever. Things like yoga or Silva mind control, all of these things. And we've been warned that these are openings to the supernatural. How do we discern the difference between useful psychological practices and things which might actually be opening us to satanic influence?
A quick and dirty working definition of Catholic discernment is knowing clean from unclean, clean from unclean exercise in terms of yoga, Reiki, reflexology, clean from unclean sexual practices, returning back to the Church's teaching on sexuality and marriage, clean from unclean thoughts, clean from unclean prayer, liturgy. So what we're seeing is this slide, and this, you know, different parts of the country, you've got influences from Central America, from Mexico, and California, or the Midwest, suburban, you're seeing more instances of yoga, Reiki. These things are open doors. In the book, I talk about how this is a two-way street. This is interactive, this interactive diabolic activity. There is no way to baptize yoga, for example. This is one of those topics that it's like the unpopular alert when I talk about this at a parish, because a lot of people are kind of stuck on this yoga form, and they don't see anything wrong with it. So long as you're not intentionally, in your subjectivity, invoking a foreign entity. But the reality is the demon works 100% in the objective. He does not care your intentionality. He works in the objective. And when you place your body into a bodily position that evokes a foreign entity, you're giving a permission, an open door to that. What does it say in Psalm 96:5? The gods of the Gentiles are demons. By invoking these things with your bodily actions, anima forma corporis, right? The soul forms the body, says St. Augustine. So when our body gets into these postures, in these positions, you're invoking something quite dangerous. In fact, the worst case of possession that I've seen in my 10 years of work here, it was one that involved Kundalini yoga by a Catholic.
I can see that you're pointing toward a more healthful spiritual approach in our own lives, leading a more prayerful life, leading a more worshipful life. That's on the personal level, on the inner level. How do we attack or defend ourselves from the onslaught of evil that's beyond ourselves? How do we, as Catholics, or even as just well-intentioned people, stand up against these forces that have become so obvious and so clearly destructive?
I use weaponry analogy. I use analogies from modern warfare, the U.S. Army Rangers, Rogers Rules for Rangers. Knowing the rules of engagement, the first rule of Rogers Rules for Rangers is that every ranger is bound by the rules and articles of war. So knowing the rules of engagement is, first of all, critical, which involves knowing the authority structure, involves the merits, the purity, the state of grace. So the biggest thing that we can do is stay within right authority according to our vocation, exercising that authority according to the office of our vocation, which orient our orientation to the church, to Christ through the church. For most of us, it's marriage. And also, and very importantly, stay in a state of grace. If you really want a nutshell, what is this? This manual is a deep dive general confession. So staying in a state of grace and staying in right relationship according to your vocation are absolutely critical. And then a lot of people think that spiritual warfare is, I got to come up with this special prayer and this prayer is going to knock it out. It doesn't really work that way. It's a grind. I'm originally from Ohio, Big Ten, and we have smash mouth football. And really what really beats the enemy is smash mouth Catholicism. So grinding it out through prayer, through sacraments, staying in a state of grace. And I think just on a personal level, I think it's absolutely critical for Catholics today to stay detached, completely detached from what's going on. That doesn't mean you're not interested. Detached is different than disinterested. We're interested in what's going on in the world. I read the news every morning and the Bible every morning, so I know what both sides are up to, right? But you have to stay detached from what's going on in the world and trust everything to the Blessed Mother, taking everything to prayer, doing prayers of reparation, etc., and also detached from even what's going on inside the church and recognizing the enemy strategy to infiltrate is going to be there. We have to be detached and have complete faith and trust in God and turn to prayer.
Is it your impression that people at this point are receptive to this? Are they even willing to acknowledge the reality, or are they dismissing the peculiarities of our time as merely psychological problems?
I think the devil's greatest tactic is to convince you that he doesn't exist. But I think his other tactic, the other extreme, to make you look for him under every single rock and behind every corner. The Catholic position is always in the middle, always watching, always discerning, always praying. But I think more and more Catholics across the country are beginning to realize there is great evil in the world. A great evil has infiltrated the church. Look at the synodal path of the church in Germany. Some of the things they're trying to introduce into the church. So the great evil is beginning to show himself. And fortunately, in one sense, fortunately, evil militates to absurdity. So when people begin to see the absurdity, they begin to step up, you know, like the Dodgers fiasco.
Right.
You know, people recognize, yeah, okay, this progressivism taking back, a little at a time taking ground. Okay, if we won't allow for gay unions to have to be civilly recognized, and then it was marriage. You know, now it's transgender identity. Now it's the office of inclusion, et cetera, at major corporations and most universities, including most Catholic universities. People are starting to say, wait a minute, this is kind of becoming absurd. And my observation, because I travel all over the country teaching and doing parish, you know, working at parishes and conferences, people are starting to wake up and they're looking for a tool. What do we do this? So this book isn't just telling stories. I could tell stories about the diabolic or what the saints said about it or whatever. This is a very functional, practical, tactical manual. There's 12 different lessons. Work these 12 lessons and work through this. And I think that's one of the values of this particular book that's coming out with Tan.
Well, where can people find out about the book?
You can go to Tan Books. Just type in the Liber Christo Method, LIBER, Christo Method, at tanbooks.com, and you can order it online there.
Dan Schneider of Franciscan University of Steubenville, The Liber Christo Method, a field manual for spiritual combat. Hey, thanks very much for being with us. These concerns are becoming more and more pressing and more apparent all the time, and the guidance you're trying to provide is timely and useful.
Great. Outstanding. Thanks for having me on your show, Bill. I respect your work very much.
More than half a century after the liturgical alterations of the Second Vatican Council, Catholics still disagree about how Mass ought to be conducted. Perhaps the most emotional conflicts center on music. What hymns we should sing, which musical styles are appropriate, even whether congregational singing is desirable at all. Such questions continue to divide us. Numerous efforts have been mounted to reform the so-called liturgical reforms of Vatican II, and one of the most articulate voices for a return to pre-conciliar musical styles within the Latin Rite is Dr. Peter Kwisniewski. Dr. Kwisniewski is a writer, speaker, editor, and a composer as well. He's taught philosophy and theology on the college level, and he's the author of books and essays that argue forcefully for a more traditionalist approach to the musical components of Catholic worship. His latest offering from Tan Books is Good Music, Sacred Music, and Silence, Three Gifts of God for Liturgy and for Life. Peter, thanks so very much for being with us.
Thank you, Bill, for inviting me.
If you would, please capsulize for us what you see as the current state of music in Catholic liturgy.
I think that we could describe the current situation as largely one of secular accommodation. What I mean by that is that the Church after the Second Vatican Council seemed to turn towards the world, and instead of preaching to the world a message that the world itself lacked and needed, namely that of divine revelation and of the beauty of tradition, the Church on earth tended to adopt the customs of the surrounding prevailing Western secular culture. And you see that in a particular way in regard to musical styles. The sudden introduction of even guitars and drum sets and pianos in churches after the council, and the sort of folksy style, sometimes tending more towards pop music or soft rock, you know, at other times just feeling a bit sentimental and even cheesy, if I could use that word. This is the kind of thing that is served up in countless churches across the world. And it's totally, I do argue in the book, it's totally inappropriate for the nature of the sacred liturgy.
Is it the style of music itself, or is it the fact that there are just so many bad, poorly written hymns now?
Well, I actually talk about both aspects in my book, the artistic quality of the hymns, and in particular the lyrics, which are often banal or even heretical in some cases. But there's also an issue here just with the musical style. There are particular ways in which liturgical music over the centuries has tended to sound and to function, and for very profound reasons. Above all, every branch of Christianity, every apostolic sacramental branch of Christianity, and indeed every religion, every ancient religion, has chant. The chanting of sacred words is the main vehicle by which the worshiper's mind and heart are lifted to the divine or to the transcendent. And this is something that's been almost completely abandoned in recent decades.
What about hymns? We have a long tradition of congregational singing. Is this a legitimate expression of faith?
Yes, I think that there is a place for hymns. I would want to make some distinctions here. The first thing I would say is that hymns properly originated in the divine office. So the hymns of Lauds, of Vespers, this is in fact what St. Ambrose, you know, composed his hymns for. The actual divine liturgy, as the East calls it, or the Eucharistic sacrifice, did not have hymns ever. Unless you consider, some people consider the Gloria of the Mass and the Sanctus to be hymns, but that's not the sense in which most people use that term. So the origin of hymns as we think of them, strophic, multi-stanza, rhyming in the vernacular with catchy melodies, that's actually something that originated in the Protestant Reformation as part of the drive to, so to speak, bring the faith to the people. Of course, what they were bringing to them was the Protestant heresy, not the Catholic faith. The response of Catholics at that time, especially in the countries hardest hit by Protestantism, was to invent Catholic hymns in the same style, and then to have those hymns being sung during Mass. So in a way, it's a bit of a foreign import, I would say. The natural home for hymns is in the breviary or the divine office, the Liturgy of the Hours. That being said, there are definitely good uses for hymns. I go to a fraternity of St. Peter Parish, so in our Mass, everything is sung in Latin from the moment it begins to the moment it ends. But prior to the beginning of Mass, that is during the procession before the asperges, and after the final blessing and the final gospel, we sing vernacular hymns very often. And I like that. You know, I enjoy singing those hymns. at those times, and the people seem to enjoy singing them as well. And I also think we just have to remember that there are many opportunities to sing outside of Mass as well. Catholics have a tendency to try to cram everything into the Mass as if it's the only thing we've got. You know, it's the only holder, the only vessel that we can fill. And, you know, there are opportunities to have, like when people gather for a prayer group or a Bible study, that's actually an ideal time to sing hymns.
The Church, of course, is universal. It's global, and it encompasses many cultures. Vatican II, as I understand it, did allow for the inclusion of certain local effects in the Mass. If we allow churches in Africa, for instance, to use indigenous singing and dancing, why not incorporate popular music styles in a Western setting?
Yes, that's a good question. Well, two thoughts about that. The first is that the missionaries who evangelized the globe, who brought the gospel and the Catholic faith to South America, to Africa, to Asia, what they brought was actually the traditional expression of the Catholic faith. They brought the Tridentine Mass, they brought Latin chant, they brought polyphony. And the natives were very impressed with this because they had never heard anything like it before. It was light years ahead of anything they had in their own culture. It's hard for us even to imagine what it must have been like to go from a culture in which people might have been grunting various songs with wooden drums or something, and then suddenly these missionaries come in with musicians and singers, trained singers, and I mean just singing this glorious music. It must have been like angels coming down from heaven, you know, as far as they could tell. So indeed, we should never underestimate the capacity of human beings in all cultures to appreciate the noble and the beautiful and perfect high art forms. So I think we shouldn't, in a sense, have the view that Africans, let's say, need to have their singing and dancing in their native styles. Well, they can have that, but they can also have the high culture and the traditional music as well. And that's what they did have until recent decades. And in fact, where the traditional liturgy still survives in Africa and South America, the people of the area, of the region, love those things. They don't feel alienated by them. So that's one point I would make. The other point is more of a philosophical point about the difference between a true culture and the artificial, largely capitalistically constructed pop culture of our times, which is a new phenomenon in history. We don't really have, I would say, in America, speaking broadly, there are pockets of traditional culture. I would point to something like bluegrass music in the South as an example of an authentic folk culture. It's something that emerged from the people over centuries of time, and it wasn't sort of artificially produced in a studio and then imposed through radios or Spotify or something on a large population. Whereas rock music, pop music, a lot of these more contemporary styles on the radio, that's not an authentic folk culture. And so for the church to enculturate by using something like what you get from a pop singer is a false understanding of enculturation. And in fact, it's going to end up undermining what you're trying to do, because those styles are very much, they're very worldly in their intention, in their words, in the lifestyles of the performers and all of that. All of that comes in when you bring those styles in.
Well, how does that differ from, say, Mozart giving a concert or Bach composing something that may have expressed Christian themes but is nonetheless an original composition and could even be thought?
Yes. Well, certainly, I mean, there's I suppose nothing I'm saying is contrary to the idea of musical genius. I mean, on the contrary, what I argue for is appreciating the heights of art to which the Christian faith has led so many great composers like Bach and Mozart, whom Ratzinger particularly loved and mentions in his book. He says that when he was a child and he went to a high mass and he heard, you know, the Mozart mass being sung, yes, this is a very Viennese classical style of music. It's not everyone's cup of tea, and Pope Pius X even kind of discouraged it for various reasons. But it's still, from a musical point of view, it's elevated and elevating and glorious music, very well crafted on a much higher level than you'll ever get in, you know, Breaking Bread hymnal or something like that. And so he says when he was, as a child, he went to these masses, he says, it was like the heavens were opened for me, and, you know, and I could see the angels. So I think that we do have to be willing to make real judgments, real aesthetic judgments about good and bad art and better and worse art. That's what I try to do in my book. I spend quite a bit of time going into reasons why we should think that there's good art, bad art, better art, and worse art.
I guess the question at this point is, where do we go from here? I mean, for a long time now, we've heard pop or folk-style music in church. People have become accustomed to it. For many people, that's what church sounds like. How do you convince people that your vision of a more elevated musical expression is, in fact, the way to go?
Yes, good questions. No, I mean, so I'd say a few things here. The first is that as much confusion as there has been in the church, if you look at the teaching of the church, if you look at all of the magisterial documents on music, which I delve into in my book, there's actually a very consistent message given about reaffirming the traditional styles of music. Now, if people have been ignoring that, that's true, but I think it's important for us to recognize that the teaching hasn't changed and the ideal hasn't changed. So it's up to us to take that seriously if we want to be fully on board, so to speak. But then I would also say there is, in fact, a revival going on of sacred music. I mean, there are many, many, many parishes around the country that I know of, around this country, but also elsewhere in the world, that are using chant and polyphony and traditional hymns and pipe organ music, you know, with great effectiveness and with a lot of, so to speak, buy-in from the clergy and the laity. And there are flourishing religious communities as well, Benedictine monasteries, for example, that are singing everything in chant. The low point for all of this was probably the 1970s and 80s, and there's been a slow kind of scrabbling attempt to put things back together ever since then. So I know it's happening. It needs to percolate everywhere. It needs to reach everyone so that we can all be touched and moved, and I would say even transformed by the beauty of our traditional sacred music and the appropriateness of it. So yeah, it's a work in progress. I do think younger people, too, are often very open to these things.
Yeah, it's been my observation that a lot of young people are drawn to more traditional religious expression. That's true. The book is Good Music, Sacred Music, and Silence, Three Gifts of God for Liturgy and Life by Dr. Peter Kwishniewski. Where can the book be obtained?
Yes, so as you mentioned, it was published by Tan Books in Gastonia, North Carolina. So you can, of course, get it from their website. And it's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all the usual places. Plus, you can ask your local bookseller to pick it up from Tan as well.
Well, thanks very much for being with us. You've tackled a challenging topic, certainly a controversial one on many levels. So we shall see what effect the book has over time.
Thank you so much, Bill. I appreciate it.
Be with us next time when we explore other aspects of religious communication and look deeper into the great Christian heritage of free expression. Free Expression with Bill Castle is a production of Good Shepherd Catholic Radio and Company Publications, where good books, good music, and good radio are always good company. Dan Kuras provided technical assistance. Theme and incidental music are by Dan Adam. The program was produced and directed by Bill Castle. This is Good Shepherd Catholic Radio.